Hey, welcome to Seneca Lake Mysteries, the podcast where we explore the unusual, strange, and unexplained on New York's largest Finger Lake. I want to thank you for listening and subscribing and commenting and for appreciating and recognizing the curious history and weird phenomena from around Seneca Lake. In this episode, following up on the recent announcement that researchers from Cornell and SUNY ESF will be studying recently discovered holes in the bottom of Seneca Lake and their possible link to the Seneca Drums mystery, we will go deeper into the history of the Seneca Drums, the theories that try to explain the phenomenon, and the time in 2009 when the U.S. government said, right now we don't understand what makes the Seneca Drums. Next, I'll have a new type of segment where I'll highlight some locally produced beers, wines, and spirits that are named after some of the unusual, strange, and unexplained stories around Seneca Lake. And then finally, we'll run through the history of the Seneca white deer at the former Seneca Army Depot. We'll look at how the deer got there, how they survived, and how white deer have been sacred spiritual symbols in numerous cultures around the world for millennia. Then I'll talk about my own experience when I was part of the first tour offered to the general public at the former nuclear weapons storage facility called the Q Area, including a completely unexpected meeting with a wee white deer. So if you enjoy the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and get over to SenecaLakeMysteries.com and sign up for the mailing list, which is the best way to make sure you don't miss a story, podcast, or update. You can also find links to all my social media when you visit SenecaLakeMysteries.com. You can email me, podcast@SenecaLakeMysteries.com, and you can also leave a voicemail, and the phone number is 607-307-1167. Thanks again for listening, and let's get into it. So in the last episode, I talked a bit about the Seneca Drums phenomenon and the history of it, but I didn't get too deep into the details. And of course, that discussion was prompted by the recent release of research results that were done by a team that explored and mapped Seneca Lake's bottom from 2018 to 2024. Now, this group, by the end of 2022, had identified more than 40 intact 19th century wooden shipwrecks. And then in 2024, they went back and they completed a systematic examination of all those shipwrecks and were able to complete a 3D image capture of each of those shipwrecks. And one of the wrecks that I find most interesting is in about 600 feet of water near one of the deepest spots in the lake lies a steamboat that's sitting upright and still has its machinery intact and aboard. But probably the most compelling piece of information that came out of this study was the discovery of a field of nearly 70 indentations or pockmarks, each one roughly 30 feet deep and 400 feet across, that lie in the bottom of Seneca Lake, roughly in the area of the Banana Belt. Now, researchers aren't entirely sure what may have created these formations in the bottom of the lake, but the primary theory that they're looking at right now is that there's a natural gas deposit thousands of feet below the lake, and those deposits are releasing natural gas through the bottom of the lake. And when those gas bubbles get closer to the surface, they expand and they make a booming noise, which would explain the Seneca Lake drum. And there's going to be a research team going back and looking inside of these pockmarks or holes to see if there are traces of natural gas, methane, or anything else that may help explain the Seneca drums. And it's important to note that these pockmarks and holes in Seneca Lake are only concentrated in that area at the southern part of the lake. There are other holes in the lake, other areas where holes and indentations exist, but this field of pockmarks is remarkable because when you look at the image, many of these holes are perfectly round or seem to be close to perfectly round, all arranged in this relatively small area, close together. Now, when I posted about the findings and I posted an image from the lake bottom, put it up on Facebook to see what people thought, I got some interesting responses as far as what people thought may have caused these holes in the first place. One suggestion was that these marks were caused by the U.S. military testing depth charges in Seneca Lake, which could be a possibility, although the military presence on the lake, Sampson, is located much further north than where these pock marks are. So I don't know if at one time the military was testing depth charges towards the southern end of the lake. But hey, it's not a bad theory. Another suggestion was that all these indentations are old plunge pools from waterfalls, which would indicate that sometime in the distant past, when Seneca Lake was forming, there were dozens of waterfalls that were all landing in this concentrated area and created these dozens of pockmarks from dozens of waterfalls. Out of all the theories, I think this one may be the most plausible, although I have no training or education in geology or anything like that. Seems like it could be a possibility. And of course, some people accept the current working theory, which is that these pockmarks were created by natural gas leaking through the lake bottom and somehow creating these massive pockmarks. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. If there's anyone out there who understands geology and these kind of things, I'd love to have it explained to me a little more clearly. Not saying that I don't believe it, I just don't understand how the rising gases would create indentations in the bottom of the lake. Now, the theory that natural gas bubbles cause the Seneca drums is a theory that's been around for well over 100 years. And for this episode, I want to dive a little more deeply into the history of the Seneca drums and into the history of the natural gas theory to explain the Seneca drums. And although the theory of natural gas causing the Seneca drums is just a theory that has not been proven, you'll still find a lot of writings and a lot of opinions expressed by people who seem to believe that this theory is actually proven and that the Seneca drums are no longer a mystery. So let's look a little more deeply into the theory, how long it's been around, and how much evidence there really is for the theory. So the first time the Seneca drums phenomenon was brought into the public consciousness was in 1850, when James Fenimore Cooper wrote a satirical short story called The Lake Gun. It was a fictional piece which poked fun at political demagoguery, and it referenced the unexplained booming sounds that come from within Seneca Lake that were heard by the early European Americans as well as the native people who lived around the lake, although Cooper's story was fictional, and he even made up a legend about the drums that he attributed in the story to the native people of the area. Now, as I mentioned in the last episode, these lake drums have been described in various ways. They sound like distant thunder, they sound like distant gunshots, or drums. Now, one of the earliest newspaper articles I could find was from 1877, and it reported that visitors to Watkins Glen would gather on summer evenings along the hillside avenues to, quote, listen to the delightful but mysterious Seneca Echo, which sounded like a mournful murmuring song of the moving billows many miles up the lake. Then in 1906, in a story outlining reports of the Seneca guns, the Geneva Gazette claimed that men of, quote, unquestioned integrity have heard the sounds at intervals along the shore and at the center of the lake, end quote, including a man named Edwin Becker, who had heard the sounds that year. Then in 1908, I found what might be one of the first references to the Seneca drums being tied to natural gas bubbles. So in July 1908, a man from Dresden, New York, named William Prosser was enjoying a Friday night of fishing in his boat near Long Point when he decided to light his pipe. When he struck the match, he saw a flash and heard a deafening roar, and suddenly both William and his boat went soaring through the air before landing among the trees on the bank an astonishing 100 yards away. Now, William was shockingly still alive, even though he was bruised and bleeding after being launched into the sky from this massive explosion and traveling the length of a football field and crashing on land. But even after his miraculous survival, William Prosser had enough of his wits about him to confidently conclude that the explosion was caused by volumes of natural gas that had bubbled to the surface, and when he lit his match, it exploded that natural gas. Now, to some extent, I find William Prosser's story believable. However, the fact that he was reported as flying 100 yards through the air, landing and living, and then declaring that the explosion was caused by natural gas bubbles makes the story a bit less credible in my mind. However, the natural gas theory really took hold in 1934, when newspaper headlines around the country declared that finally and conclusively the puzzle of the Seneca Lake drums had been solved through the scientific process. So a Dr. Herman L. Fairchild of the University of Rochester submitted a report to Science, which was the official periodical of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And in this report, Dr. Fairchild explained that William Prosser was essentially correct, that the lake guns were caused by bubbles of natural gas escaping from a layer of sandstone deep within the earth, and that these gas pockets would find their way through openings in the lake's bottom and then expand up to 20 to 40 times their original volume due to the decreasing pressure as they ascended through the water. And the bubbles would then burst when they reached the surface, resulting in a booming sound. Now, in the report, Dr. Fairchild gave credit for the discovery to A.M. Beebe, who was a geologist for the Rochester Gas and Electric Corporation. And Beebe had noted that there were a total of 130 natural gas wells in the vicinity of Dundee, New York, between Seneca and Keuka Lakes. Beebe further noted that due to the volume of natural gas extracted from the Dundee area gas wells, the underground pressure of the gas had been greatly relieved. And in the previous summer of 1933, there had been no reports of any sounds coming from the lake, which led Beebe to conclude that the famous lake guns had been silenced forever. And as I mentioned, this report made national news, and the press excitedly trumpeted the scientific triumph and had dramatic headlines such as, quote, "Scientist finally explains the century-old mystery of Seneca Lake's invisible guns," end quote, and, quote, "Science solves old Seneca Lake puzzle," end quote. So according to these people, it was all over. The enigma had been debunked, and the drums had permanently gone quiet. Then in 1940, the Geneva Gazette reported that a reliable neighbor almost had his canoe overturned by a great bubble that had surfaced in the lake and burst with a loud noise. Then in 1943, Geneva City historian Eleanor Kleiss heard the lake drums around midnight on the lake's western shore near Dresden. And then in the summer of 1947, multiple summer residents on the eastern shore near Kandaya and Hector, as well as on the west shore near Himrod and Glenora, reported hearing the lake drums. So it didn't take long before the whole theory of the lake drums being silenced forever was debunked. And according to many Seneca Lake residents, these sounds have continued over the years through to the present day. Although the number of reports has declined, they never stopped. Now, there were some other theories that were put forth over the years claiming that the lake drums might also be tied to the salt deposits next to and underneath Seneca Lake. In 1977, Walter K. Long, the director of the Cayuga Museum of History and Art in Auburn, New York, told the Associated Press that Seneca Lake is situated atop huge salt deposits and many hollow caves. And he stated that these deposits were a, quote, "likely source for the noises," end quote. Now, Walter Long also claimed to have heard the lake drums himself, but he still admitted that neither he nor anyone else had been able to figure out exactly what caused the sounds, even acknowledging, quote, "we've all guessed at it," end quote. And it's also notable that he doesn't explain in any detail why salt deposits sitting below the lake would cause booming noises. Which reminds me, and again, I'm not an expert in this field, but in the research that I've done, I see that there's been observations of natural gas leaks coming from the ocean floor and the bubbles of natural gas making sounds as they ascend to the surface and pop. However, in these cases, these are smaller bubbles that come up. To my knowledge, there's never been a situation where large bubbles were being released and observed making their way to the surface and making exploding noises or booming sounds, which indicates to me that although the natural gas theory may be the most likely theory that we have, it's still just that, a theory. And there really isn't any observed evidence at this point that natural gas bubbles would come up from the lake floor in large amounts and large bubbles that would make these sounds. Now, one of my favorite pieces of information I found about the Seneca drums comes from what is one of the most comprehensive summaries of the phenomena and its possible causes. And this report was published in October 2009 on the official website of the United States Geological Survey, the USGS. So the piece is titled Earthquake Booms, Seneca Guns, and Other Sounds, and it explores the reports of these booms from around the United States. And I'll post a link to this report in the description for the podcast. Now, some examples of the booms that are mentioned in this report, a 2001 swarm of small earthquakes in Spokane, Washington, which were accompanied by booming sounds, the 1811 to 1812 earthquakes in New Madrid, Missouri, which included accounts of all artillery-like sounds both before and during the earthquakes, an 1886 earthquake in Charleston, South Carolina, which included multiple reports of sounds being heard prior to the earthquake that began as trembling or murmurs that increased to a roar, as well as noises like loud detonations accompanying the aftershocks in the following weeks. And of course, the Seneca guns, as well as similar booms heard on nearby Cayuga Lake and along the coasts of North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Now, what's so interesting about this piece is that it goes over all the possible causes for these sounds. So the first one it suggests as a possible cause is the possibility of sonic booms from military aircraft. However, it does mention that the reports of Seneca drums occurred prior to the existence of supersonic jets. Another possible cause mentioned is military training exercises, specifically naval ships firing guns offshore. And while that explanation might fit with the sounds heard along the southern U.S. coastline in the 1800s, early 1900s, it could not have been the source of the Seneca guns during the same time frame due to the lack of military vessels on Seneca Lake at that time. Now, although it's not mentioned in the USGS article, it's definitely possible that military exercises being undertaken between 1942 and 1956 at Sampson Naval Base, later Sampson Air Force Base, on the eastern shore of Seneca Lake, were mistakenly attributed by witnesses to being the Seneca guns. But obviously, this would not explain all the reports of lake drum sounds before and after that 14-year time frame. Now, earthquakes have been cited as a possible cause of some of the Seneca drums phenomena around the world. However, the USGS states that in the cases of these booms that they reviewed, none of them were found to match any seismographic records. The article goes on discussing other potential causes that they eliminate in the piece as being the cause of the Seneca drums, including tidal waves, landslides off the continental shelf, industrial explosions, shifting of tectonic plates, new tectonic faults forming, air pockets being released, meteors, lightning, and even top secret military activity. Now, the USGS does address the natural gas bubbles theory that has been offered to explain the Seneca Lake sounds, but they note that naturally occurring methane gas does not come up suddenly enough or in large enough amounts to cause booming sounds or explosions. But far and away, my favorite part of the entire article is the final paragraph, which concludes that the Seneca guns phenomenon simply has not been explained. And here's the paragraph. And remember, this is coming from a government agency, the USGS. Quote, there does not appear to be any agreement on what causes the Seneca guns. They have been occurring in several places around the eastern U.S. and in India for at least a century or two. As far as I can tell, they have worried people, but have never caused damage or injury. The Earth is a complex place, and there is a lot about it that we don't understand. Perhaps someday we will understand what causes Seneca guns, but right now, we don't understand what makes them. However, they do not seem to pose a threat to anyone. So that was in 2009. We're now in 2025, and the mystery of Seneca drums still hasn't been solved. And really, the biggest point that I want to make is that the natural gas theory of the Seneca drums is based on the assertion that the Seneca drums stopped when natural gas was extracted from areas around the lake. The whole theory hinges on this claim that nobody hears the Seneca Lake drums anymore. Well, this is not true. People do hear the Seneca Lake drums to this day. I've spoken with people who've heard them recently. And then a while back, I saw a video online. It was a short video of one of the tour guides at the Finger Lakes Welcome Center in Geneva on the shore of Seneca Lake, speaking to a visitor and explaining to them that the Seneca drums are natural gas bubbles coming up from the bottom of the lake. This tour guide was speaking with utmost confidence, saying that nobody hears the lake drums anymore after the drilling was done and the mystery was solved. And when this visitor mentions that they had heard these sounds, the tour guide says, well, then you heard one of the gas bubbles. Now, nothing personal against this tour guide. They're doing what they were taught. They're doing what their job is. But they're misinforming people when they make this claim that nobody hears the lake drums anymore. People do hear them. And whenever I hear someone claim that the lake drums were silenced years ago, it feels to me like gaslighting. Natural gaslighting, if you will, but gaslighting nonetheless. Bottom line is, right now, the Seneca drums are a mystery. We don't know what causes them. Now, there will be more research done here in the near future, and maybe that will help solidify the natural gas theory. But right now, the Seneca drums remain a mystery. So for this segment, I want to do something a little bit different. I want to spotlight some of the businesses in the Seneca Lake area who are in some way acknowledging and celebrating the unusual, strange, and unexplained history of the region. Now, keep in mind, these are unsolicited recommendations. I haven't spoken with any of these companies, told them I was going to be doing this. Of course, anything that is discussed on this podcast does not reflect the opinions of any of these companies that I'm going to mention. And they didn't ask me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And for starters, I want to begin with a few of the beer producing companies in the area. And these are in no particular order. I'm going to start with a beer that is produced by Scale House Brewery over in Hector, New York. The beer is called Lake Monster Lager. And they have it on tap. They have it in cans. The artwork on the can is really cool. It has kind of a vintage cartoon look to it. And if you're interested in trying Lake Monster Lager, you can learn everything you need to know at scalehousebrews.com. Now, another beer, actually an IPA, that I want to mention is produced by Warhorse Brewing Company, which is part of the Three Brothers Winery, and it's called It Came from Seneca Lake Quad IPA. Now, the artwork on these cans are also fantastic. It's kind of a vintage comic book style illustration that shows these big tentacles coming from the lake and hovering over and winding through the streets of downtown Geneva. So that's another one, and it's called It Came from Seneca Lake Quad IPA, and you can find out more info if you go to www.threebrotherswinery.com. And finally, on the list for beer producers is Lake Drum Brewing in Geneva, New York. And Lake Drum produces beers and ciders. And if you want to learn more about Lake Drum Brewing, You can go to lakedrumbrewing.com. So moving on to the wine producers. We'll start with J.R. Dill Winery in Burdett. And they actually have a line of wines that are called Jabberwocky. Now, this is based on a character from a Lewis Carroll novel called Through the Looking Glass. And the creature in that novel was called the Jabberwock. So J.R. Dill is kind of tipping their hat to Jabberwocky. And also the artwork shows sort of a winged creature kind of rising from the lake. And Jabberwocky is available in white, red, and a carbonated blush called Jabberwocky Rise. You can find these wines and learn more at jrdillwinery.com. And now we're going to move to a couple of the more prominent haunted locations on Seneca Lake. And we'll start with Miles Winery, which is in Himrod. And they have a wine called Ghost. And it's a white wine. It's based on the various ghost stories that have been told around the Miles Winery mansion for many, many years. The labeling on Ghost White is really wonderful, too. It's a, depending on how the light hits it, it shows kind of a image of a ghost moving through the wine bottle. Hard to explain, but you can find Ghost White and you can learn more at mileswinecellars.com. And then, of course, we have from Bellhurst Castle and Winery, Isabella Sparkling Rosé. Now, Isabella was, or is, the legendary ghost that haunts the grounds of Bellhurst Castle and down along the shore. As the story goes, Isabella was a opera singer who moved from Spain to the United States and stayed at Bellhurst. And at some point when the authorities came for her and her lover, they tried to escape through a tunnel. The tunnel collapsed and Isabella was killed. And there's lots and lots of other stories of hauntings at Bellhurst Castle. And you can learn more by going to www.bellhurst.com. And finally, we'll move on to spirits. And we have Finger Lakes Distilling Company down in Burdett that produces a gin called Seneca Drums Gin. It's an award-winning gin. It's made from grapes from the area, as well as botanicals. And, of course, it celebrates Legend of the Seneca Drums. And if you want to learn more or get your hands on some Seneca Drums gin, you can go to fingerlakesdistilling.com. So yeah, that's just the short list that I've compiled to date. If you have any suggestions, if I missed any, if there are other companies out there making beverages that tip their hats to the weird and unusual history of Seneca Lake, please let me know. And I mean, there's got to be somebody out there who's serving meals. They have a sandwich named after the lake monster, something like that. I'd love to see any cannabis companies in the Seneca Lake area maybe name a strain after the lake monster or something else to do with the strange history of Seneca Lake. So yeah, send a message, send an email, give me a call, let me know if there are any others that I missed. So last episode, we talked about the Seneca Army Depot in Romulus and its history as one of the primary munitions depots in America, providing weapons and other supplies for every U.S. military action from World War II through the First Gulf War. Now we move on to the story of the iconic Seneca White Deer. So when the Seneca Army Depot was built in 1941, a 24-mile fence was put up around the area to keep intruders out, but at the same time, it essentially entrapped a population of white-tailed deer who would now live and breed within one of the most secure military facilities on Earth. But it turned out that among these newly captive white-tailed deer were some who carried a recessive gene that causes leucism, a condition in which the animal doesn't have the cells capable of making pigment, which turns their coats white in color instead of brown. These are different than albino deer, in which the cells are unable to produce melanin, but with leucism, the cells aren't able to produce any pigmentation at all. So it turned out that the white deer that were living on the depot's land early on, the numbers were either too small or the deer themselves were too elusive to be spotted. But then in 1949, an officer at the depot witnessed something that at the time must have been pretty mind-blowing for him. He saw two white deer, one male and one female, together on the grounds of the depot. And shortly thereafter, Colonel Franklin Kemble, who was the commanding officer of the depot, issued an order that prohibited any hunting of the white deer. And that decision was critical in ensuring the continued existence of the white deer population. So the decision to prohibit deer hunting at the depot ended up being revisited a few years later because in the winter of 1955, more than 1,000 deer died due to lack of food from overforaging and the large population, as well as harsh weather. So in response, the U.S. Army began developing a deer management plan with help from Cornell University and the New York State Conservation Department. They began allowing annual deer hunts in 1956 by servicemen to keep the deer population on the base below 900, which was believed to be the maximum capacity for the 17-square-mile site. And at first, only brown deer were allowed to be hunted, but later some white deer were harvested as well. And it turned out that this deer management plan used at the depot was the basis of deer management efforts used around New York State, because the white deer were wild but also captive, so researchers and scientists were able to experiment with various population control methods, including genetic studies and fertility control, contraceptive methods. And it turned out that the fertility control effort was too expensive and impractical, so the best option was hunting with regulations, and that's a policy that's since been adopted statewide. So the white deer population at the depot eventually increased to around 300, but after the depot was decommissioned and closed, the fences started collapsing and deteriorating, and many of the white deer escaped and got hit by cars or ended up being hunted. However, over the years, a series of advocates for the white deer came forward, and eventually they've established Seneca Army Depot as a natural preserve where the white deer can survive and thrive. And the latest estimates place the white deer population at around 80 to 100, with new fawns being born every year. So what is it about white deer that makes them so fascinating and that causes excitement when they're spotted? It could be, I think, something about them that touches our subconscious or triggers a response in us on a very deeply human level, because white deer have been part of stories and myths, often tied to the supernatural in cultures around the world and throughout time. Celtic and Hungarian history, the white stag appears and leads heroes on their journeys. The legend of King Arthur includes several appearances of the white stag. In Kamakura, Japan, the origin of the Buddhist temple Enkaikuji revolves around a group of white deer who came out of a cave to hear the founder of the temple speak. The Lenape people from northeastern U.S. believed that seeing two all-white deer indicated a time when the original people would come together and share knowledge and wisdom with the world. The Ojibwe people believe that the white deer reminds us of the sacredness of all living things. In China and Korea, seeing a white deer brings good luck. And there are many, many more stories around the world. But overall, white deer have symbolized a connection to nature and to the divine for many people for a very long time. So I'll stop here and provide an unsolicited advertisement for Deer Haven Park. It's located on about 7,000 acres of the former depot, and they give tours. They have a welcome center, a museum that celebrates the history, the military history of the depot, as well as the history of the white deer. There's no other place like it in the world. I highly recommend you pay a visit when you can. Take a car tour, a bus tour, a walking tour, whatever. It's well worth the trip, and you can find out more info at deerhavenpark.org. And now I'm going to share one of my own stories of a special tour I took at Deerhaven Park last year and a weird encounter we had with a white deer. So it was in July 2024. Deerhaven Park announced that for the first time, members of the public would be able to tour inside the queue area of the Seneca Army Depot. It was called the Queue Tour, 80 Years of Secrecy Revealed. And as I discussed in the last episode, the queue area was where nuclear weapons and nuclear materials were stored from 1956 until the depot closed in the 1990s. It was one of the most highly secured military facilities in the world. Currently, the property within the queue area is leased by First Light, a fiber internet company, and a representative of First Light actually ended up guiding the tour of the queue area. Now, before this tour, the only people who'd been allowed inside the queue area were First Light employees, other workers, or people who lease space within the area, and members of the 295th Military Police, who toured the queue when they had returned to the area for a reunion. And there had been some other people who likely had been inside the area after it closed, you know, people from the county, what have you, who were there during the time when they were deciding what to do with the old depot. So on the day of the tour, me and the other visitors that were taking the tour, probably 40 to 50 of us, loaded onto a flat open-air wagon that was being pulled by a large truck. And so in the blazing July sun, they took us into the queue area. They showed us the entrance gate, numerous buildings. Some of the buildings were abandoned. Some were being used by First Light or other tenants. We saw the specialized reinforced storage igloos that held the large percentage of the U.S. military's nuclear materials for over 40 years. They showed us the modified storage igloo that houses a First Light data center, so it has electricity and climate control and security and all of that running into it. So we saw a lot of cool things. I'm going to talk about some of this in a future episode, but our encounter with one white deer fawn ended up being my most memorable moment of the short time I spent inside the queue. So at some point in the tour, we were going down a road by some of the igloos, and all of a sudden a white fawn came walking out from an overgrown wooded area to the left of the tour wagon. Now, not only was the fawn completely unbothered by the presence of the truck and all these people and the wagon, she seemed kind of curious and was walking toward us. So the tour guide says, "Hello, Bella," and then he goes on to explain that Bella is a white deer who had become acclimated to the employees who currently worked in the old queue area. So she wasn't afraid of humans, would often come around, and they had even given her a name. And the tour guide also mentioned that Bella often traveled with a friend. And right after he said that, sure enough, a small brown fawn strolled out of the brush, also looking curious, but probably definitely more hesitant than Bella was. And the tour guide mentioned the brown deer's name, but I can't remember it because the whole scene was just so crazy. First of all, nobody told me that there was such a thing as a friendly white deer who would walk up to people. White deer are quick and elusive, and like all white-tailed deer, even brown ones, they're going to move the other way if a human gets too close. They just don't walk up to you. So it was something I didn't even consider possible. And then Bella walked around the wagon and truck and was standing a few feet off the gravel road across the road from where she had first appeared. And I was sitting all the way to the back of the wagon, so I had an unobstructed view from maybe 30 feet away, looking directly at the white deer. So I pulled up my phone, started to take photos, and then I realized that she wasn't just standing there. she was taking a leak. She was urinating, taking a wee. So I took a few more photos as the wagon was slowly pulling away, and she finished up her tinkle there. And I just put my phone back in my pocket when someone said, "Look, she's chasing us." And I looked up, and sure enough, that little white deer was trotting along the center of the road, looking like she was trying to catch up with the wagon. So I attempted to get out my phone and take a video, but in my haste, and I messed something up, so there's no video. But I still got some solid shots of that little white deer casually taking a whiz while everyone watched, and I'll post that photo in the description of the podcast. So even though it wasn't a supernatural encounter, being approached by a white deer who then comes closer and casually pees before chasing your vehicle down the road inside of a former nuclear weapons storage facility is certainly unexpected and decidedly weird. Well, that's it for this time around. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for listening. And if you have any thoughts on any of the topics in this episode, please let me know. And remember to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And get over to SenecaLakeMysteries.com and subscribe to the email list so you don't miss anything. A new podcast comes out every month on the 7s. I'll talk to you then.